Thank you very much, Raghav, for the invitation. Today I will be talking about quantum error correction at large n, and maybe this quantum error correction story is not very familiar to people in the audience, so please stop me anytime and I will answer your questions. So let me start from some historical reference and motivation. So quantum error correction seemed to be tightly related with holography, as was shown in this paper by Almeri, Donk, and Harlow in 2014. And just intuitively, error correction generally implies redundancy. And indeed, in the examples of ADS-CFT, we typically deal with large gauge groups. So it's natural to assume that maybe this quantum error correction structure comes from gauge singlet condition. And indeed, it was explored in this paper in 2015. And it seems that singlet states, they do play a big role in the holography. For example, it was argued that in the IR gravity description of D0 brain quantum mechanics, only singlet states are present and charged states are separated by a gap. And apart from the holography, singlet states, they also show any interesting properties. For example, recently it was demonstrated that in some very simple models, one can build the so-called scarce states. These are states which do not thermalize. So it seems that even from some practical point of view, it seems an tantalizing possibility to use scars for scarce states and singlet states for quantum information storage. So in this talk today, I would like to emphasize the importance of the large chain limit. So namely, I would like to argue that in the large chain limit, there is a version of quantum error correction in the gauge singlet sector, regardless of the Hamiltonian. And I will discuss the matrix models. One can think about the reduction of Young-Mills or tensor models. And in the end, if I have time, I will explain why everything I will be talking about doesn't apply to vectors, vector models. Maybe one comment I can make briefly is that generically in vector models, there are not much singlets, unlike matrix and tensor models. So I should say right away a lot of disclaimers my research was motivated by holography, but in fact, in this talk today, I will be dealing with quantum mechanics of fermions. So it will be purely boundary perspective. And I will deal with fermions because they are much nicer. They're the Hilbert space finite dimensional and a lot of operators just square to one. So they're very nice. But in general, there is no ideological abstraction to deal with bosons. And maybe a more important disclaimer is that in the story of Almeri, Donk, and Harlow, it was really important that the bulk is local. So their notion of quantum error correction heavily relied on bulk locality. But if you take a generic matrix model, you don't expect that it will be dual to something local. So it was discussed around 2004 that even the simplest matrix harmonic oscillator can be given interpretation in terms of two-dimensional string theory. But in this case, there is no locality in the bulk. And so the story of the quantum error correction I will be talking about today, it's more pertinent to these stringy geometries rather than this nice ADS-5 with large radius. So, and the question I would like to answer today is, how robust are the singlet states in these models against errors such as erasures, for example? So this is the motivation for today. Are there any questions about these, or maybe comments, disagreements? Let me then proceed. So the outline of my talk is this. I will very, very briefly in one slide illustrate quantum error correction by this holographic example by Almeri, Donk, and Harlow. Then I will illustrate my claim in a very simple setup without even referring towards quantum error correction and so on. And then I will introduce a very simple and basic quantum error correction and the formalism of error operators. And then I will apply these techniques to matrix models and tensor models. In my talk later, I won't need any statements from holography. Nonetheless, let me illustrate what Almeri, Donk, and Harlow did. In very simple terms, in holography, we say that we have some d-dimensional boundary theory. And here I draw a spatial slice. So one can think that the time is perpendicular and there is one-dimensional boundary slice. And inside, it's filled with Poincaré disk. And one important feature of holographic correspondence is the causal wedge reconstruction. Essentially, in the large chain limit, you can say that there are three fields propagating in the bulk. So one can study a simple wave equation in five dimensions and essentially reconstruct the field behavior in the bulk based on some limited boundary region A. So for A, it will be the region, the gray region chi A. And for example, if I want to take the union of the regions A and C, this so-called causal wedge will be bounded by chi B, in fact. So these three regions, they neatly split this Poincaré disk in these three regions. And now I ask the following question. How much access to the boundary I need in order to reconstruct fields around point O? And what we see is very nice. O does not need the knowledge of the field behavior in all A, B, and C. I need only two out of three regions. So something might happen in region C, I add perturbation, for example, but then I'm still able to reconstruct O from A and B. So the stuff in the center of the Poincaré disk is very well preserved. So this is a simple geometric picture of quantum error correction, or just error correction in general. Unfortunately, if you take a generic quantum mechanical model, it might not have special locality. You can think about, again, some SYK or matrix models, but still we can study the robustness against erasures. And maybe I should say the following comment is that below I will assume that my matrix or tensor models have certain symmetry. And one can think about them, the proper way to think about them as of a gauge symmetry. In one dimension for quantum mechanics, gauge symmetry does not do much. So it simply says that all your physical states are singlets, but adding a gauge field does not introduce new degrees of freedom in 0 plus 1 dimension. So I can, in a way, engage my symmetry and treat it as global. And I need this because I want to study error operators which are not singlets. And for example, in BFSS matrix model, it was demonstrated that in fact, non-singlets are separated by a gap. So this way in the low energy, I won't add anything extra. And moreover, one can also argue that if we want to build a quantum computer simulating a certain gauge theory, generically our degrees of freedom will be just raw qubits, which are not singlets. So this ungauging procedure is kind of natural from this point of view. So now let me illustrate my claim in a very, very simple setup. So suppose I have UN matrix model. So I have some Majorana fermionic operators. So I and j are indices in the UN. I start from a singlet state, which is supposed to be, if we're lucky, it is dual to some stringy geometry. And then I add some errors or perturbations, you can call it whenever you like. So I form two states, Xi1 and Xi2. So these states now are definitely non-singlets. They have uncontracted UN indices. And then the question I want to answer is this, is there a measurement which can distinguish Xi1 and Xi2? Because if there is a measurement, then these fermionic matrices are Majorana. So in fact, they square to one. So if someone handles me a state Xi1, and I know that it's Xi1, then I can act with Psi 3-1 again. It will square to one, and I will recover my original singlet state, which might contain some message I want to decipher. But if I think that it's Xi1, but in fact it's Xi2, and then I act with another operator Psi 3-1, then it's disaster. It's not good. I will not go to my original singlet. And the basic rule of quantum mechanics is that there are classical measurements distinguishing states only if they're orthogonal. And so what I need to do is I need to compute the overlap between these two states. And I have chosen my indices very carefully such that when I compute the overlap, I have this combination. And since S, is a singlet, I can essentially decompose this product of three adjoints into irreducible representations. And the only surviving thing is a singlet operator. And since there are three index contractions in this trace, I need to divide by n cube. And in general, there might be some 1 over n corrections if it is SUN instead of UN, and these corrections are totally unimportant. So I have this, and generically we don't expect that it's zero. So generically I cannot expect that the singlets form any nice subspace which is robust against perturbations. However, so the central claim I would like to make is that in fact the matrix elements of singlet operators, they can be bounded by certain power of n, which is smaller than the naive n cube. So naively, you can say that, okay, psi squared to one, I have n cube terms. And so roughly matrix elements should scale as n cube, but it's not the case. So the claim, the central statement is that it scales slower than n cube. So it's only n to 5 over 2. And this is why Xi1, 2 are orthogonal in the large n limit. And so one can come up with a measurement which will distinguish Xi1 and Xi2 with error of order 1 over n. And this is why singlets do form a protected subspace, at least against some non-singlet erasures or perturbations. So this is like a key statement. I think we should pause here for questions if there are any. Okay, if there are no questions, let me go on. So my goal for today is essentially generalize these two things, this statement. And what I told you, there are essentially two parts. So first, I need to bound matrix elements of singlet operators, and then generalize this state orthogonality to the full machinery of quantum error correction. So let me start from the first one. And so there is certain bound on matrix element everyone is familiar with. So suppose I start from some two Majorana fermions and create and make creation and annihilation operators out of them. And then I can define a Fock vacuum. This is by no means a physical vacuum of my model. So this is just some Fock vacuum for representation of these Majoranas. And then I can form the so-called closed string states by arcing with these trace operators. And it's a sort of widely known in closed circles statement that these are approximately orthogonal in the Lakshian limit. You can easily check this by starting, you know, computing weak contractions in the overlaps between such states, and one can immediately see that there will be extra one over n's if this set of you know, closed string quantum numbers m are not the same. Moreover, like with the same logic, if I have trace of psi to the m, then I will be contracting psi's within itself. And because of this, in fact, this matrix element will scale as this n to the power of 1 plus m over 2. And in fact, this is the familial Hooft scaling, that a single trace operators scale just like n, but it's in a different normalization. It's when I normalize psi by square root n. So already we see from here that if I start from this Fock vacuum, then indeed my matrix elements, they scale slower than n to the number of contractions. So it's naively, it would be n to the power of m, but now it's m only m over 2. But unfortunately, this statement has a caveat. In all this, I implicitly assume that these closed string numbers are parametrically smaller than m. Otherwise, if they're of order n, then it makes the combinatoric much harder, and I'm not aware if anyone done the full computed the full answer in this case. And but if you are willing to accept that all the physical states, only singlet states you want to consider, are close to this artificial Fock vacuum, then sure, it's already a victory, because this, you see, it scales slower than the naive expectation. So we need some different argument if we want to show that all singlets form a protected subspace. And for this, we can employ the following simple observation, is that if I compute the trace of psi to the 4, so where 1 now is a flavor index. So each psi here is a matrix, and I multiply it by itself 4 times, take trace. Then one can reshuffle psi's and get that it's exactly equal to the identity operator. So it should have been like bold 1. It's identity times n cube. And this is true generically. I did not assume anything about the states here. And essentially my claim is that by a simple cutting and gluing procedure, one can always reduce to this operator. For example, if I have a product of different psi operators, so where I assume now that I have 4 different flavors, I compute this trace. What I can do is I can separate Hermitian part and anti-Hermitian and treat them separately. So I get this. After this, if I study a diagonal matrix element, then for any operators, I have this simple, you know, like full square inequality. And I can apply this to the sum. So essentially, it will be A is psi 1, psi 2, and B is psi 3, psi 4. So if I do this, I can essentially reduce the upper bound to finding the upper bound for this operator. And I can repeat this procedure and essentially arrive again to this, the operator I started from. So, and essentially what I just did on this slide is that I bounded this operator with 4 flavors again by n cube. And obviously I did not assume anything here about a Fock vacuum or the number of, you know, closed string excitations in my singlets. It's just a generic inequality. And and so one can continue this procedure for operators containing more psi operators and so on. And so let me just state this. So if I have a single fermionic operator made from M fermions, not necessarily single trace, so it can be a product of single traces, then I claim that there is the following bound, so which depends on you know, how many psi's you have, what is it modulo 3. And so for original operator with 3 psi's, this is the 5/2 I promised you. So the only limitation here is that it cannot be, this operator cannot contain too much psi's. So I used some very simple combinatorics and very loose bounds, and I got that k cannot be larger than n to the power of 1/4, but I'm sure this can be improved. Essentially, this limitation arises because once you start, you know, cutting and gluing operator containing too much psi's, in the end, you get too many quartic operators, and this is why it becomes, you know, it starts to violate this bound. And as a cross check, one can easily see that in fact these bounds they are so the Tov scaling obeys these bounds. So at least there is this simple bookkeeping, which provides a test for these bounds. Any questions so far? Okay, let me now move to the formalism of quantum operators. So if I have some unitary evolution, then it can always be inverted because I act with a unitary. But in general, if I have a system interacting with the environment, the proper evolution equation is this one. So essentially, I take my density matrix rho and act by this sum of operators E. One can think about them as errors or perturbations again. And this equation is very easy to understand and derive. One can imagine that you have a closed quantum system. When then you bring it in contact with some environment, and together they undergo a unitary evolution, and then you trace out the environment. And after very simple algebra, you essentially arrive in this equation. This is the equation I want to study. And so it also obeys very simple sanity checks. So there are positive operators on both sides. But on top of that, I need to require trace preservation. So, and for this, I need the following equality. And if you start with some unitary evolution with the bath, you will get this automatically. But in general, if you have some, you can treat these operators abstractly, and then you need to impose this requirement. So, for example, this way one can treat a possibility of spin flip with probability p. So X is some is a Pauli matrix acting on a qubit, and it can flip it, and it happens with probability p, and with probability 1 minus p, this doesn't happen, so the system is just left alone. And if with the proper normalization, I need to take the square roots of this, and since x squared to 1, you will see that this trace preservation is indeed there. So, as I said earlier, unitary operations can be inverted for any state. But generically, these quantum operations are not invertible. I say that E alpha is invertible for some family of density matrices. If for any density matrix in this family, I can come up with another quantum operation which will take me exactly to my original density matrix. However, this requirement is very, very strong. So it just says that I will reconstruct my initial density matrix with perfect accuracy. And see in the large N, and generically what people like to discuss in quantum error correction literature, is the approximate quantum error correction. Essentially, it says that there is some error correction operators R, which don't take me exactly to my original density matrix, however, but it takes it very, very close. So this norm here, you can think about this as a trace norm or fidelity, they in fact equivalent. So so this will be good enough for us, and essentially I will see that in this large N story, this epsilon, it scales as 1/n. And also Almeri, Duncan, Harrell in their paper, they also mentioned that once you are outside large N limit, the quantum error correction holography will not be exact, but it will be approximate. So a very useful theorem is due to Kneel and Laughlane. So I have some family of density matrices which are supported on some subspace of my Hilbert space. And then I have a set of error operators. Then the question is this error set invertible for this set of, for this subspace or not? And the answer turns out that it is invertible if and only if the following equation holds. So I take a product of two errors, project them on my code subspace, and what I get is the, again, the projector times identity operator times some Hermitian matrix. So n alpha beta here, it is not an operator, it's just these are numbers. So in our case, I'm claiming that my code subspace is a subspace of SUN singlets and E alpha non-singlet operators. In fact, this is directly related to the story of state orthogonality I mentioned earlier. Because, in fact, without loss of generality, one can assume that this matrix N is diagonal, in fact, proportional to identity matrix. And then when I dress this Knill-Laflamme condition with operators in the code subspace, I see that once I add errors are essentially orthogonal to each other. And this is what physically allow us to reconstruct the initial state, because if errors are orthogonal, I can come up with a Hermitian measurement, which will tell me what error occurred. And then with this knowledge, I can apply the correction operator and go to the original state. So in our case, they are almost orthogonal, because as in that example with adding psi's, this psi's can actually, form a singlet. So then they are indices might conspire such that when I compute this matrix element with in a singlet state, there will be some singlet operator. So the Knill-Laflamme condition does not really hold. However, it holds in large N limit. So this is why I needed a bound on singlet on matrix element of singlet operators to essentially say that it will be suppressed by 1 over N. And from here, one can in fact explicitly construct the recovery procedure. So essentially now my errors are only approximately orthogonal. And what I need to do is I need to construct a nearest orthogonal basis to these error states. So state which is E beta acting on S, this family is not orthogonal, but I can find the nearest orthogonal basis. So in linear algebra, it's known as orthogonal Procrastes problem. And in quantum information, it's known as pretty good measurement. And so I construct this Hermitian operator, and which tells me with probability, with failure probability 1 over n, which error occurred. And then with this knowledge, I can again concoct a correction operator. So in fact, this this procedure of pretty good measurement that was discussed independently by many different people. And essentially for this, I will, as I said, this procedure is explicit if I know these states and these operators, but it requires taking the square root of this matrix. And so essentially this problem boils down to, you know, estimating what these matrix elements are and how this is close to identity matrix and then bounding some norms or eigenvalues of this matrix. So I think this is essentially kind of the bulk of I want to say. Now I'm going to apply this to matrix and tensor models and describes some subtleties. So are there any questions about this matrix elements bounds and quantum error correction procedures. Okay, then let me just describe. I have 20 minutes, so I will briefly describe what happens in matrix models. So I essentially already described you these bounds on matrix elements in the matrix models. So essentially, I have this set of Majorana fermions, which are in the adjoint of SUM. And A is a flavor index. And these guys, in fact, after I choose an appropriate basis in SUN, orthogonal basis in SUN, they satisfy usual normalization in the Majorana commutation relations. And in fact, they're equivalent to qubits by Jordan-Wigdon transformation. In fact, earlier I referred to these error operators abstractly, but in matrix models, it's natural to say that my errors can occur in some fixed set. So I can essentially say that there is a set E of qubits where an error can happen. And then my error, but it does not really tell me, it does not tell me much. So I say fixed set, but it does not tell me where exactly error occurred or in what combination. So essentially my error operators will be all possible strings which I can mate from this set. So this, you can think of them as beads, and then I form all possible necklaces of these operators. And I don't have time to describe this, but in fact, correcting all possible errors like this is equivalent to correcting the erasure of E. So one can think that some error occurred which actually put the reduced density matrix on E in the maximally mixed state. And then I can still correct that, in fact. This is equivalent to correcting all possible strings of psi from E, and the strings, they can have arbitrary length. So in matrix models, there is one quite annoying problem. I call it bilinear problem. It's because the bounds I obtained, unfortunately, they don't show any 1/n suppression in bilinears. So if I take an operator like this, and then I ask for its matrix element in a singlet state, it will be of order one. So it happens when I have essentially conjugate elements in SUN. And in fact, yeah, these singlets are not able to correct these conjugate errors. So, and the only thing I can offer you is to avoid them. But in tensor models, actually, this problem will not be present, at least in some tensor models. So another problem is actually not a problem, but it's a limitation on this procedure. So this, if I have error which is too complicated, which contains a lot of operators, then again, my bounds may not be applicable. And this, in fact, happens when I have of order n errors. So if I have order n errors, again, this wouldn't work. And it happens not only because of the bounds, but also for an entropic reason. It's because if I have a product of k fermions with uncontracted indices, and I now start to, building all possible singlets out of these K operators, then the number of such singlets will grow factorially. and it will overcome 1/n suppression. So this factorial growth, which is this is what in fact prevents me from correcting arbitrary long errors. Putting aside all the algebra and some poor combinatorics on my side and some loose bounds, so what I managed to prove is this. So the errors I just described, they occur in some large set E. And then one can explicitly build this recovery. And this recovery works with this precision. So it's bounded by the number of qubits in my E divided by n to the two fifths. So as long as I don't have any bilinears and avoid this bilinear problem, and also because of this factorial growth, it says that my E cannot be too large. So again, there are some there will be some limitation on the size of E. And as I just said, this can be probably improved. And moreover, all these fractional powers might not seem impressive, but it actually happens for a reason. And because I'm actually, I relaxed my error correction to approximate error correction, but it's still in some sense physical, and I need to relax it more. And I will tell you in the conclusion what is what's another physical requirement I need to relax. Let me now describe these tensor models. So in for matrix models, I did not really tell you what the model is, because there are lots of tensor models. I'm sure everyone is in the audience at least encountered a matrix model. But tensor models are slightly more exotic. And so let me tell you the motivation. Why do I want to study this field content of these Majorana fermions and the fundamental of O n cube? So, but again, as in matrix models, this large N results, they will not be tied to any particular Hamiltonian. I just want to motivate why would I even study these tensors. So these tensor models in fact related to SVK. So the simplest model is so-called Karozat-Anaza-Klebanov-Tarnopolsky. So it contains its Hamiltonian contains terms which are quartic in these Majoranas, so they live in the fundamental of O n cube, and this mass of indices can be depicted in a nice way by a graph. For this operator, it's a tetrahedron. So the black dots are psis, and different color lines are index contractions in different O n's. They are contracted this way to form a tetrahedron, and this is a Hamiltonian. So it looks very simple, and in fact, it has the same large N limit as the SYK. So one can write down exact Schwinger-Dyson equations and the large N limit, and then they coincide with SYK. But unlike SYK, it doesn't have a disorder average. But however, there is some subtlety here, because it's widely believed that this model exactly coincides in SYK, you know, in the strict large N limit. However, what concerns 1/n corrections, again, people believe that it's different from SYK. Well, it's not really belief, because there are, in fact, 1/n corrections which are not simple power counting of 1/n is different from SYK. So in 1/n is different from SYK. Although the Schwarzschild is there, one can draw these ladder diagrams, and so this theory is maximally chaotic. However, there is another version of this model, so-called Grau-Witten, and this model is more complicated, but in fact, up to 1 over n squared, it is known that it coincides with SYK. So the only difference between Grau-Witten and Karo-Zatanaza Klebanov-Tarnopolsky is that I add these flavors 1, 2, 3, 4. But because of that, I actually need to promote the number of gauge groups from n cubed to or n to the 5. So, and I will not talk about this model, although it's it seems very interesting that it's and highly non-trivial that in 1 over n it coincides with SYK2. So these are the two interesting models which have non-trivial dynamics. And this is why I can also ask, it's reasonable to ask what happens in the singlet sector of these models. So now I, as in the matrix case, I need to derive bounds on matrix elements. And naively, if we look at this Hamiltonian, it contains six index constructions. And again, each psi squared to one. So naively, it scales as n to the six. But in reality, it scales n to the five. And this is actually important to compare this model to SYK. As a side note, let me say that, in fact, there is a tighter bound for this specific Hamiltonian. In fact, the tight bound is believed to be 9 over 2. And then this way it gives exactly the same value as an SYK. But this tighter bound is difficult to prove, but I was not able to generalize this to other operators. So just keep in mind that all the bounds are a priori loose. So how can we see that it scales as n to the five? It's actually very simple. I can again use this inequality from kindergarten, and I can separate a full square where index I is some multi-index. So it's just sum over whatever you want. And what I do is that I take this tetrahedron and cut it in two and get these two halves as on figure B. And then I glue them to themselves. And then this way I get this operator, which is again four fermionic operator, but it's different. In fact, this operator is it's very similar to this psi to the four in matrix model. It also it has a group theoretic meaning. It's a Casimir of a certain group action, and one can bound it by n to the five. Again, by just analyzing what kind of representations you have in your Hilbert space. So this simple cutting and gluing again produce this geometric operator, which can be bounded by n to the five. This way again, in my paper I outlined a formal procedure. How to cut and glue operators with the following result. This bound again tells me that the matrix elements, they scale slower with n than you expect. Again, this holds for any singlet state. So I did not need to introduce any Fock vacuum. This holds for any singlet. So this, again, I have some limitation on the number of errors, but the whole singlet subspace provides a protected subspace against errors. This model without additional flavor, it's very nice because it doesn't have this bilinear problem. As if I take this bilinear, then it can form a singlet only if A, B, C, and A prime, B prime, C prime coincide. In this case, it just squares to one. So the only bilinear which is singlet is identity. So I don't need to worry about that. And this way I get this bound again, that my erasure set again consists of separate qubits, separate Majorana fermions. And so this error, it's bounded by the size of my error set divided by n squared. So are there any questions about this tensor models before I go to the conclusion? Okay, let me then summarize. So my claim is that for matrix and tensor models, unlike vector models, large chain and singlet condition automatically implies correction of errors. And this holds for any a singlet state and for any Hamiltonian, as long as the number of erasures are not too large. And for this, I would like to actually comment because it kind of seemed unimpressive, but that my error set cannot be too large. But in fact, what I was requiring in my procedure was too much. And for this, we need to go back again to this picture of Almeri, Duncan, Harlow. So here, as I said, the errors in the middle of the Poincaré disk, the operators in the middle of the Poincaré disk are very well protected because if something happens to A, B, or C, it will be intact. But in fact, if I something happens in C, and then I want to reconstruct something within this wedge of C, then it will be gone. So in fact, in holography, we expect that we will not be able to reconstruct the original state completely. So some information will be lost after all. Whereas in my story today, what I was requiring is that I can reconstruct the whole state completely. And this is why I had my error set was constrained. So some information is lost after all. And in fact, this issue was discussed by Harlow in his 2016 paper. And so this version of quantum error correction, when some information is lost after all, is called some system quantum erasure correction, which essentially relaxes Knie-Laflamme condition by saying that if I have product of errors and I project them on my code subspace, then the resulting thing is not necessarily identity operator. So it can produce some non-identity in the subspace A, and then information in A will be lost. So it would be interesting to discuss this subsystem quantum erasure correction in matrix and tensor models. Also, unfortunately, in what I told you about today is purely algebraic. I didn't have any geometry. But the massive deformation of certain matrix models have fuzzy spheres as vacuum, and fuzzy spheres they do have a notion of geometry, and so it would be interesting to see what if there is anything I can extract from saying that I am in the fuzzy sphere vacuum. Another interesting question is What happens if I study singlet errors? Because if I truly want to preserve gauge symmetry, then all my errors have to be gauge singlets too. But it's more difficult to analyze because essentially in what I told you today, it was important that my run a fermion squared to one, so it can I can easily correct an error if it happens in a single my run. But if error operator is another single, then it can act quite in a quite convoluted way. And so even if I know what error occurred, I might not be able to correct it. And another more like observation rather than an open question is that this gauge requirement or requirement that I have a singlet, it's actually very similar to so-called stabilizer codes people study in quantum information. Essentially, most of the quantum error correction codes people discuss, you know, in real life while working with qubits are so-called stabilizer codes. So if I have a bunch of qubits, my algebra of operators, essentially products of Pauli matrices, it's called Pauli group. And I can essentially separate an abelian subgroup in this Pauli group and ask for states which are stable and invariant onto this abelian subgroup. And in fact, almost all known quantum error correcting codes can be built this way. This formalism is very powerful and allows you to avoid a lot of calculations. So in my case, I was essentially, instead of taking some abelian subgroup of discrete group, I was imposing the condition of being a singlet. So it would be interesting to see if this can be maybe applied for real qubit systems. And finally, I did not say anything about the dynamics. So all I told you was some algebra and powers of n counting. But for example, in BFSS matrix model, it is known that singlets, non-singlets are separated from singlets by a finite gap in the large n limit. And so it would be interesting to study what happens with the error correction in this case when I actually take into account that I have energy and energy conservation and so on. Okay, this is all I have for today. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Alexey, for a very nice talk. Maybe we can take questions if there are any.
Yeah, I actually have some questions. Just to sort of get the big picture story here. So if you're looking at the paper by Harlow and so on, right, there the motivation behind this error correction was that that of reconstructing a bulk operator while only having access to part of the boundary. And so I'm just wondering if there's a similar like physical motivation here. So in the sense that we'll say you have a matrix model and you want to treat singlets as the your code subspace, sort of like in which situations would I want to think of the system as like having errors introduced by, you know, like maybe single fermions acting on a singlet state?
Yeah, essentially what you say is that you start from some, so in this Almeri-Don-Harlow situation, you started from a state on the boundary which had a bulk dual, and then something happened to part of your system. For example, you lost access to it. Or you know, you apply some operators on C, right, and you are not able to, you know, measure this stuff on C, and you don't know what actually happened. And then you just say, okay, whatever, I have A and B, and this is good enough. And the same happens in this matrix models. Essentially, you say that I have a singlet state. I can do whatever I want with it, but now something happened to it. So for example, you can imagine that you build this matrix model on a quantum computer. And then you carefully prepared your state such that it's a singlet. But then you have some stray photon and it flipped one of your qubits, and so it's no longer a singlet. But then you can say that there is an operation that this way, that then you can say that, okay, if mile n is large, such error can be reconstructed with 1/n error.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I guess maybe let me rephrase my question. Like after a couple of steps in the ADS-CFT picture, this is sort of more or less, like morally, I would say, equivalent to entanglement wedge reconstruction. And then, so here, you seem to be saying there is something similar for these matrix models, although there's clearly not like a, you know, like local subsystems which correspond to parts of your, like sides of your matrix model. So I don't know, can you speculate on what sort of the analog of that would be?
Yeah, I think the analog is that. So even if you take some system which is supposed to have a holographic dual, only certain states will have a smooth, you know, bulk dual. Right. So you can say only these states possess this error correction property. And here in this matrix and tensor models, I'm saying that these good. Such good subspace is a space of all singlets. These singlets are, in some sense, distinguished. They are good states as if they are analog of having, you know, a smooth bulk dual.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I had something to ask as well. So for BFSS matrix model, we know that there is some region where at least the behavior of the thermodynamic behavior is independent of whether you take the singlet sector or the non-singlet sector. So can you say something about how the errors will look like in the non-singlet state? And is there some, like, is there some similarity they can have to the singlet sector in BFSS matrix model?
Oh, yeah, very good question. So in BFSS, it looks, there are some picture and it looks nice, maybe even almost too nice. So mm-hmm. In BFSS, essentially, the story goes like this. So the BFSS has non-trivial dilaton profile. So maybe I should remind others how it works. So in BFSS, you have this thing in the middle, deep inside, and that corresponds to some low energy state, low energy physics. There is a black hole in there, and as you go to the boundary, it corresponds to some UV regions, and then corresponds to, you know, UV physics. And if you add a non-singlet perturbation in BFSS, then we argued with Juan that essentially it will this non-singlet perturbation, it will look like a folded string, which will be stuck near the boundary. So it seems in BFSS, the picture is regarding non-singlet errors is very nice, because you can explicitly see that low energy, you know, things around the horizon will not be destroyed if you add a non-singlet perturbation, as it will stay near the boundary, which corresponds to UV.
I see. Okay, so maybe, are there any more questions for Alexei? Okay, if not, maybe we can thank him again and stop the recording. Thank you for the talk, Alexei.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. Yeah, it was a pleasure.